You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast series that covers a broad spectrum of national and international legal issues. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Lucy McCann.
Over the years, LawPod UK has covered a number of important aspects to clinical negligence litigation. Most recently, Emma Louise Fenelon spoke to Margaret Barron KC about how to avoid disaster when it comes to expert evidence, and I'd highly recommend that episode to all our listeners who practice in this field. Today, I'm delighted to welcome to the pod for the first time Cara Guthrie and Matthew Flynn, both barristers at One Crown Office Row, who are going to expertly guide us through multi-defendant cases. Matthew and Cara, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lucy.
Before we dive in, the LawPod UK team, Rosalind, Emma and I, want to hear from you, our listeners, about why you listen, what you like, what you don't like, and what topics you'd like us to cover. Over the past 5.5 years or so, we've amassed over 700,000 listens, and we'd really like to take stock on what we're doing well and what we could improve on. So please do get in touch via the anonymous survey linked in the episode description. So, back to the world of multi-defendant cases. Starting off with the fundamentals, Matthew, why is it sometimes the case that there can be multiple defendants in the same claim?
Thanks, Lucy. So obviously, when something goes wrong in life, there can be more individuals or organizations involved than just one claimant and just one defendant. And in tort law, there are four basic kinds of liability which can describe what's gone wrong. So first, we can have joint liability. And this is where the actions of two or more defendants combine to result in one tort causing damage, and each defendant is liable to compensate the claimant in full. And most commonly in this context, we might think of a common venture. And an example in the clinical negligence context could be two doctors designing a negligent treatment plan for a patient. But it can also arise from the nature of a relationship. So for example, an employee who commits a negligent act will be jointly liable with his employer through the principle of vicarious liability. So that's joint liability. Secondly, we can have joint and several liability. And that's where two or more defendants commit separate torts, which both cause the same damage to the claimant. So for example, a mechanic might fail to fix the brakes in a car, and that car is then driven too fast by a negligent driver, causing an accident and injuring a pedestrian. So that's joint and several liability. Thirdly, we have several liability, and this is where two or more defendants commit separate torts, causing different damage to a claimant. And this can be quite common in a personal injury and clinical negligence context. An example might be where a claimant is injured in a car accident and goes to hospital for inpatient treatment, whereupon, for example, due to a lack of turning, he develops pressure sores. Finally, there's alternative liability, and this is where one of two or more defendants will be liable to the claimant, but he or she doesn't know which one and so sues all of them. And I remember, Cara, you telling me about a case you had like this, where a claimant underwent surgery and there was a failure to give him prophylactic antibiotics, and I think there was a dispute between the surgeon and the anaesthetist. Is that right?
Yes, that's right, Matt. So in that case, the anaesthetist said, well, I would normally administer the prophylactic antibiotic, but only if the surgeon asked me to. And in this case, the surgeon didn't ask me to. Whereas the surgeon said, I did ask, and it's the anaesthetist's fault that it wasn't administered. So on those facts, the claimant was bound to recover damages from one or other of them. It was just a question of which one.
Right, so there we go. That's a nice example of alternative liability there. And those are the four main types of liability which can involve multiple defendants, Lucy.
So what are the considerations for a claimant when deciding who they should sue?
Well, in general, claimants want to keep litigation as streamlined and simple as possible. And it's certainly the case that claims with only one defendant are far easier for a claimant than claims with multiple defendants. And so I'd say that the main principle is that a claimant should only sue more than one defendant if they think they need to. Is it necessary in order to maximise the chance of securing full recovery? And when they make the judgment about whether to sue extra defendants, a claimant will want to think about whether the potential benefits outweigh the practical and tactical difficulties that can arise, and also the risk of there being an adverse costs order at the end of the case.
So why might it be necessary to sue more than one person?
Well, I think the first point to make here is that it's not always necessary. And the first two types of liability we talked about earlier at the start of the podcast episode, joint liability and several liability, these are the sorts of cases where the claimant can sue one defendant to get compensation for the whole of their injuries and damage. So in that context, there's a real choice as to whether to bring in more than one defendant, and how to make that choice is something we can come on to. But you're right, there will be some cases where it's quite clear that the claimant needs to sue more than one defendant to make sure that they're fully covered for their injuries. So for example, in cases of joint or joint and several liability, although in theory one defendant could be responsible for the whole of the damage, it might in fact be necessary because the case on breach of duty against the defendants is not a slam dunk and the claimant wants to have more than one bite of the cherry. So that's one instance where it might be necessary. Another instance might be because one of the jointly liable defendants has no insurance or funds to meet the damages claim, and you want to make sure that whatever judgment or settlement is reached will be effective. Or it might be the case that if you don't sue everyone involved, you risk not being covered for all of your injuries and losses because no one defendant can be said to have caused all of it. And that will be the case in the second two types of liability we discussed at the start, several liability and alternative liability. Now, for alternative liability, it's pretty obvious. If one of two defendants must have caused you injury, but you don't know which, you're going to have to sue both or risk choosing the wrong one. Obviously not an ideal scenario. But it can also be necessary in several liability, which, as an aside, can also be known as consecutive liability, because in such cases, defendants will try and argue that they are only responsible for compensating the claimant for the torts and the injuries that they caused in both the factual and the legal sense. So take the example I gave of the car accident. Although in a factual sense, the car driver can be also said to have caused the pressure sores in hospital, since the claimant wouldn't have been confined to a hospital bed but for the car accident, the failures in preventing the pressure sores are arguably so distinct from the failures causing the car accident that the negligent driver would have a reasonable argument to say, well, the chain of causation is broken, I shouldn't be responsible for the pressure injuries and their consequences. Now, I should say that this area, dealing with when legal responsibility for a causative chain of events is broken, could be an entire podcast episode in itself. The court will want to consider things such as how grave and disconnected the subsequent negligence was, and for the principles about when D1 may or may not be held responsible for the subsequent negligence of D2, I'd recommend listeners noting down the cases of Webb and Barclays Bank, Rachman and Area Rose, and a recent Scottish case called Widdowson's Executrix and Liberty Insurance Limited, which reviews the case law in this area.
What are the potential downsides for a claimant from a tactical perspective of suing more than one person?
Well, the main problem, if you sue more than one defendant, is that they might all gang up against you. So the defendants can cooperate with each other. So they can agree to share information with each other before they share it with the claimant. So sometimes defendants will agree to exchange pleadings with each other on a without prejudice basis, or they might agree to exchange their factual and expert evidence prior to service. And the advantage for defendants of that cooperative approach is it means that they all get a greater understanding of the case as a whole. And so all the defendants can see where the strengths and weaknesses of all the parties are. And for example, if one defendant takes a pleading point and the other defendant thinks, yes, that's a good point, that defendant can choose to plead the same point, even though it didn't occur to them at the beginning. And that sort of has the effect of reinforcing the point being made by the original defendant. Or, you know, sometimes one defendant gets a report that is supportive of the defendants, and the other defendant might have obtained an unsupportive report. But in those circumstances, the second defendant can choose to rely on the first defendant's report. So the claimant will never know that there was an expert that had actually agreed with the claimant's expert in that case. It doesn't always happen, but one defendant can invite his experts to comment on the allegations made against the co-defendant. And so you can have two lots of experts saying that the criticisms made by the claimant are unfounded. And then finally, even if both defendants are in fact critical of each other, they could agree to keep those criticisms to themselves so that they don't prejudice their positions vis-a-vis the claimant. And you can imagine in a case where the two defendants have provided similar types of care. So I've got a case at the moment which is about wound management. Was a wound bandaged appropriately? And the claimant is criticising a dermatology unit, some GP nurses and community nurses. And in that case, all three defendants' experts are saying what we did reflected a reasonable standard of care. And you can see that a judge, when applying the Bolam test, will be very unlikely to conclude that all of them is wrong. And then you can have the same point on causation. You know, it might be that all the defendants' experts give evidence saying that the claimant's injuries was the inevitable consequence of his or her underlying condition, rather than having been caused by any negligence. Another potential downside is that it can be more difficult to settle a claim if there are multiple defendants, and if one of those defendants is absolutely determined not to admit liability, and particularly if the co-defendant thinks that that stance is a reasonable one.
So from a claimant's perspective, are there any potential advantages? Because Cara, that's a very compelling case for not wanting to sue multiple defendants. So what are the potential advantages to a claimant for doing so?
Well, sometimes you need to, as Matt said. I suppose the main potential advantage is that when it comes to it, one defendant will end up blaming the other. And so it may be that one of the defendants actually does support the claimant's case. And sometimes that defendant's experts may be more critical than the claimant's experts had been willing to be. And then the other advantage is if all the defendants acknowledge that they're at risk of losing a case, it can actually make it easier to settle a case because they get to share the liability between them. And so the cost for each individual defendant is less than it would be if they were facing the whole claim.
So to the issue of costs, Matthew, what are the costs implications for a claimant of suing more than one defendant?
The sordid topic of costs, everyone's favourite, I'm sure. look, it's unavoidable that the more parties there are to litigation, the more costly it will be. And a claimant, particularly now, for reasons we'll come on to, has to think very carefully about where those costs could end up lying once all is done and dusted. Now, many personal injury and clinical negligence claims will attract the protection of a qualified one-way cost shifting, i.e. the QOX regime. But under CPR Rule 44.14, a claimant will not benefit from that protection if they succeed in getting damages in some form against one defendant, but they lose against another that they have brought into the claim. Now, there's some quite helpful dicta explaining the rationale for that in a case called Cartwright and Venduct Engineering Limited. And in that case, Lord Justice Coulson explained it in a quite a helpful way at paragraph 32. So what I might do is I'll just read that out for you. He said, "In my view, a result which requires a claimant in the appropriate case to pay a successful defendant the amount of the costs order made in favour of that defendant out of sums payable by way of damages and interest to the claimant by an unsuccessful defendant is precisely in accordance with what Sir Rupert calls, quote, the necessary elements of a one-way cost-shifting regime, unquote. It is important that claimants are discouraged from bringing proceedings which are unlikely to succeed. Claimants with QOX protection should not think that this general principle does not apply to them, or that they can issue proceedings against any number of defendants with impunity." So that's what Lord Justice Coulson said. Now, by the time this episode goes live, claimants will need to be even more careful about this. It used to be the case that a costs order against a claimant could only be enforced against damages and interest made in a court order, as Lord Justice Coulson referred to. And that was actually one of the key points decided in Cartwright. But now, due to amendments to Rule 44.14, that decision in Cartwright has been overturned by the new rules. And a cost order can now be enforced against not only damages and interest, but also a settlement sum and damages payable by way of a Tomlin order, that being a schedule to a court order. and against cost sums payable to a claimant, and that overturns a decision in another case called Ho and Adelaikun. So in the past, a claimant could settle against one defendant and discontinue against another and feel comforted in the knowledge that their settlement damages and costs could not be touched by the defendant against whom they discontinued. But now, rather than discontinue, it might be more prudent to agree a drop-hands offer with the other defendant so that the settlement damages and costs remain protected, because otherwise they're rendered vulnerable by the recent amendments to Rule 44.14.
Matt, just one point to, or two things to say there. Firstly, that the amendment to Rule 44.14 only applies to cases which are issued after the 6th of April this year. But the other thing that has occurred to me is this really just takes us back to where we were in the old days before the Quox regime came into force. Because before Quox, if a claimant sued multiple defendants, they were at risk of having to pay the costs of a successful defendant, because the ATE insurers would define success as being success against any defendant, which meant that it wasn't the ATE insurer that would pick up any adverse costs order, it was the claimant. But in reality, we didn't see that causing huge problems, and generally a sort of winning defendant would be so pleased to be let out of the litigation that they would agree not to pursue their costs against the claimant.
Thanks, Cara. And yes, I think another effect of this, when we come to the end of litigation, is likely to be much more focused once again on things like bullock orders and Sanderson orders. So a bullock order, which was named after a case called Bullock and London General Omnibus Company, is an order which requires the claimant to pay the successful defendant's costs in the first instance, but allows her to recover them from the losing defendant as part of her total costs of the action. So that's a bullock order. A Sanderson order, named after a case called Sanderson and Blythe Theatre Company, is an order which requires the losing defendant to pay the costs of both the claimant and the successful defendant. And I think in this new regime, once it comes into effect for claims issued after the relevant date, there's going to be much more interest and desire to secure one of those orders on the part of claimants. So the question is, when can a claimant obtain such an order? Well, there's a case called Moon and Garrett in which Lord Justice Wallace said this: there are no hard and fast rules as to when it is appropriate to make a Bullock or Sanderson order. The court takes into account the fact that if a claimant has behaved reasonably in suing two defendants, it will be harsh if he ends up paying the costs of the defendant against whom he has not succeeded. Equally, if it was not reasonable to join one defendant because the cause of action was practically unsustainable, it would be unjust to make a co-defendant pay those defendants' costs. Those costs should be paid by a claimant. It will always be a factor whether one defendant has sought to blame another. So that's what Lord Justice Wallace said, and I think in broad brush terms, the dominant question is going to be whether or not it was originally reasonable for the claimant to join the defendant against whom it has now failed. And what does reasonable mean in this context? Well, it means, was there a sustainable claim against both defendants, for example? Was it a case of alternative liability so that the claimant had to sue both in order to ensure recovery? Or did one defendant blame another, effectively requiring or prompting the claimant to draw another defendant in? That will be another relevant consideration, although it won't always be decisive.
What is the position when one of the defendants makes a unilateral Part 36 offer to the claimant?
Okay, well, that all depends on the type of case that you're dealing with. So the relevant provision of the CPR is Rule 36.15. And if it's a case where the defendants are jointly liable or there's alternative liability, then the claimant can accept the offer, but if he wants to accept the offer, he must discontinue against the other defendants. He can't carry on against anyone else. And either the defendants must consent to that, or the court must give permission for the offer to be accepted, because it will need to make orders about the other defendants' costs. However, if it's a case of several liability or joint and several liability, and the claimant wishes to accept the offer, then the claimant can do so. And as long as they haven't recovered all their damage, they can carry on suing the other defendants. I think it probably goes without saying that a claimant can never recover more than 100% of his loss. So the fact that in a joint and several case, each defendant theoretically could be responsible for 100% doesn't mean that he can ever recover a total of more than 100% of his loss.
And because of that, you always need to be quite clear in terms of the settlement as to the extent to which that settlement is intended to cover the claimant's losses.
So what are a defendant's choices if they think that another person has negligently contributed to the claimant's injury and the claimant seems only to be pursuing them?
Well, there are three main options available to a defendant in that scenario. One, persuade the claimant to bring in another defendant, although note again the potential ramifications of that when the court is considering things like Bullock or Sanderson orders. Secondly, the defendant could bring a fellow defendant into the claim by way of a Part 20 claim. Or thirdly and finally, you could decide to forge on alone and make a claim against the other defendant later under the Civil Liability Contribution Act 1978.
So on that, from a tactical perspective, why might a defendant decide to leave such issues to be resolved in subsequent contribution proceedings rather than in the main action?
So the point on contribution proceedings is you've got some time to take stock. A defendant has 2 years from the date of an order awarding damages or from the date of a quantum settlement in which to bring a contribution claim. And we know that a defendant can seek a contribution from another party where it's settled a claim rather than the claim going all the way to trial. And a defendant can claim a contribution from a second defendant without actually having to prove that it was in fact liable to the claimant. It's enough that for the claimant to have had a prima facie case against the initial defendant and for that defendant to have settled the claim in good faith. But thinking about the factors that are in favour of separate contribution proceedings, I would say that firstly, where there's just one defendant, that defendant can handle the or make decisions about the tactics and settlement negotiations in any way that they see fit. There's no need for them to liaise with any other party. It means that the main proceedings will be simpler than they would be if there were multiple defendants involved. And that means that the costs are likely to be lower too. It means that the defendant doesn't run the risk that a co-defendant could raise a cutthroat defence, i.e. blame him. And it, as Matt said, avoids the risk of one defendant being ordered to pay the other defendant's costs. So I'd say as a general proposition, following up the overriding objective of keeping things as simple as possible, aim to deal with these sorts of issues in subsequent contribution proceedings. However, that might not be the best course if, for example, the defendant actually needs the claimant's factual evidence to prove negligence on the part of the other defendant, because there's no way a claimant is going to get involved in subsequent contribution proceedings. There are also some cases where if you don't have the other potential defendant involved in the main action, there's just going to be a serious lacuna in the evidence, and that could make things very difficult, both for the parties and for the court. And there I've got in mind the kind of pickle that the parties nearly got themselves into in a case called Wright and Cambridge Medical Group. And then if you've got a case which is likely to be very complicated and costly anyway, it may be that the cost of adding on one more defendant at the beginning doesn't actually pose the same disadvantage as it would in a more straightforward case.
So on that evidential point, Cara, could you talk our listeners through that case that you just mentioned, Wright and Cambridge Medical Group, that was decided in the Court of Appeal?
Yes, so as you say, that was a Court of Appeal decision actually back in 2011. And notwithstanding that it's now 12 years old, I think it should remain compulsory reading for all parties considering whether to sue more than one defendant or whether to bring Part 20 proceedings. So in that case, the facts were that there was a GP who negligently delayed in referring a claimant to hospital. Then the hospital negligently delayed in diagnosing and treating the claimant once he'd been referred. And it was accepted that had the GP referred the claimant promptly and the hospital not been negligent, that the claimant would have avoided injury. However, even with a negligent referral, had the hospital not been negligent, the claimant would have avoided injury. And in that case, the claimant, bravely, only sued the GP. The first instance judge found against the claimant on the basis that the hospital would have managed the claimant negligently, regardless of the timing of the referral, and so the claimant's injury wouldn't have been avoided. The Court of Appeal, though, allowed the appeal on the basis that the court should assume that the subsequent management by the hospital wouldn't have been negligent. And so you can see how close the claimant came to failing against the GP. And in that case, all three Court of Appeal judges admonished the parties for the decisions that they'd reached about the case. It may be that they didn't appreciate the existence of the protocols that operate between the various medical defence organisations, which preclude one healthcare defendant blaming another. The Master of the Rolls in that case described it as little short of absurd to have a long hearing which involved many medical expert witnesses, a great deal of whose evidence was devoted to the treatment which the claimant underwent at the hospital, without the hospital actually being a party to the case. And he went on to say, and this is more relevant in general terms, to say, it's certainly right to keep the number of parties to a minimum for reasons of cost and time. However, in some cases, it can be more expensive in terms of cost and time to omit to join a relevant party. And this, as I see it, was plainly such a case. If the claimant had lost, as the judge concluded that she should have, then the same issues as were canvassed before him would have had to have been examined in a subsequent claim against the hospital. And if the defendants had lost, as I consider they should, then those issues may well have to be debated in contribution proceedings between the defendants and the hospital. So apart from the concern about time and costs in this case, there's a real risk of inconsistent findings. Each party took an unwarranted risk in not joining the hospital. And it also seems to me that there may well have been a better chance of a negotiated settlement if the hospital had been a party.
So equally, why might a defendant think that it's better to have all the potential defendants in the main action rather than bringing Part 20 proceedings further down the line?
Well, there are a number of advantages to having all the parties involved in the main proceedings from a defendant's point of view. And the first and most obvious is probably that there's then no need to issue separate proceedings subsequently under the Civil Liability Contribution Act, because that question of contribution and apportionment between the defendants is and can be resolved at the same time as the main claim is being resolved. So that's one thing. It also ensures that the additional defendant or defendants are part of the debate and that the claim is fully explored with all the evidence and with everyone at the same time. Thirdly, the claimant may assist in advancing the claim against the additional defendant, which I think is something Cara has touched upon previously. Or conversely, the additional defendant may assist the first defendant in defeating the claim against the claimant. And then finally, where there are multiple parties separately insured, they might be attracted to the lower cost of a spread settlement, which might make things easier to resolve in the end. And just as there is advantages to having a single set of proceedings, a corollary of that is that there are disadvantages to having separate subsequent contribution proceedings. So firstly, it can be more costly in the long term if you need to bring a fully self-contained second set of proceedings, which is not compromised quickly. If it went all the way to a trial, that's going to be effectively two actions with all the costs associated with them. Secondly, you could lose the potential benefit of having a team of experts, again, something Cara has touched upon previously. And then finally, you might not get the witness evidence you need because not everyone is involved. It is difficult to imagine claimant, once they've got their damages, deciding to subsequently involve themselves in a contribution claim to help the defendant they originally sued. So for that reason, yeah, there can be real disadvantages to having a separate set of proceedings.
And what are the costs implications for a defendant of joining a Part 20 defendant or persuading the claimant to add another defendant?
Well, if the claim fails, you could end up paying the costs of the defendant that you brought into proceedings under Part 20. And there's a case called Wagoner and Weekend Travel Limited, which deals with that. So in that case, the claimant was injured on a skiing holiday and sued the company which organised the holiday. But that holiday company then joined the skiing instructor by making a Part 20 claim. Now, the claimant's claim failed in its entirety. So the holiday company did not need to pay damages to the claimant, and it followed from there that the skiing instructor did not need to pay any damages to the holiday company. And in those circumstances, the Court of Appeal held that Kwok applied to the main claim brought by the claimant against the holiday company, but it didn't apply to the Part 20 claim against the ski instructor. And what that meant was that the holiday company was liable to pay the ski instructor's costs. So that's a really important decision to bear in mind if you're a defendant considering whether or not to bring someone else in under Part 20. If the whole claim failed, you could be liable to pay the costs of the additional defendant that you brought in. Because even though at root it was a personal injury action, you as a defendant do not benefit from Kwok's protection.
And Kara, what are the factors which the court will consider when determining how liability should be apportioned between defendants?
So the statute which deals with this is the Civil Liability Contribution Act 1978. And Section 2 of that act is drafted very broadly. It simply says, in any proceedings for contribution, the amount of the contribution recoverable from any person shall be such as may be found by the court to be just and equitable, having regard to the extent of that person's responsibility for the damage in question. And it's clear from the Act that the court could apportion liability, you know, the full range from 0% all the way up to 100%. And when we're thinking about what does just and equitable mean, it's worth noting that those same words feature in the wording of Section 1 of the Law Reform Contributory Negligence Act, 1945. And there haven't been many appellate authorities on this point because it is quintessentially an exercise of judgment by the first instance judge. And the only Supreme Court decision on the point that I'm aware of is the case of Jackson and Murray, decided in 2015. That was a road traffic accident case in which a speeding car driver injured a 13-year-old pedestrian who stepped out from behind a minibus. And the issue for the court was the extent of the contributory negligence of the 13-year-old pedestrian. In the judgment, their lordships recognised, perhaps unsurprisingly, that a judge's assessment will never be demonstrably correct, that an assessment of apportionment is inevitably a somewhat rough-and-ready exercise. And they said that the assessment of apportionment will involve considering both the relative blameworthiness of the parties and the causative potency of the different negligent acts. And it's apparent from their judgment that they didn't regard one of those features to be more important than the other. So the kind of matters that we have to think about when deciding on apportionment are the roles of the defendants and the nature of the duty that was owed. Sometimes it can be the number of opportunities that each defendant had to intervene. Things like the timing of the negligence can be a relevant factual matter. I think it's worth saying that there can be a very wide range of unappealable assessments. And so, you know, my assessment of what would be an appropriate apportionment might be different to Matt's or different to a judge's, but we could all come up with a different answer, but it doesn't necessarily mean that any of us is wrong. I don't think you could ever appeal on the basis that a 40% apportionment is wrong and a 25% apportionment would be right. It's about a judgment call, and there is a wide range of possible outcomes.
So you'd really only be thinking about appeals and situations where something looks extremely wrong.
Exactly. Has the judge made a clearly wrong decision? I don't know if you know, Matt, the case of ZZZ and Yeovil District Hospital. That was one of these cases where there's a personal injury action with a clinical negligence action on top. And so we had a negligent car driver driving on the wrong side of the road who crashed into the claimant. And then the claimant went to hospital, and it was the A&E nurses, it was said, who had negligently not followed the spinal cord injury protocol. In that case, Garnham J decided, in fact, that there was no loss caused by the hospital's negligence. But he also said that any attempt to persuade him that the hospital was more to blame than the car driver was bound to fail, that he didn't see how you could possibly say that a car driver driving on the wrong side of the road was less to blame than A&E nurses working in a busy, pressurised apartment looking after multiple claimants at the same time.
Are there any special rules relating to interim payment applications where there are multiple defendants?
That's a good question. And there is just one discrete technical point which we probably should draw to our listeners' attention. And if we look at the wording of CPR Rule 25.7, subparagraph 1E, that gives the court the power to award an interim payment if, firstly, the claimant is bound to recover damages from one defendant or another. So that's our alternative liability situation. And secondly, both defendants are either insured or are a public body. And I've got precisely this coming up in one of my cases at the moment, where two insurers are having an indemnity fight with each other. So each insurer is saying, I'm not the insurer responsible for meeting the damages in this case. But we know that one of them in the end will be found to be responsible. And so the expectation on the part of the claimant is that the court will order an interim payment, so the claimant won't suffer just because the two defendants are having a fight between themselves.
Well, Cara and Matthew, thank you so much for coming on the podcast to discuss these issues. Clearly, there's a lot to think about when parties are involved in multi-defendant cases like the ones you've discussed today.
Look, Lucy, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. And you're right. There's a lot to think about when you're dealing with cases which could involve multiple defendants. And today we've really just scratched the surface. But I hope that we've given listeners some key steers about the sorts of things, the sorts of issues that you need to be thinking about. But which of those will be most useful to you is inevitably going to be highly fact dependent.
Well, Cara and Matthew, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. As ever, we will link all of the cases that we've discussed today in the episode description. And finally, to stay up to date with all the latest developments in medical law, do subscribe to the Quarterly Medical Law Review, which is a fantastic resource written by the barristers at One Crown Office Row. Again, I'll link the archive in the episode description. Thank you very much for joining me today, Matthew and Cara.
Thank you.
Bye, Lucy.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Lucy McCann and produced by the barristers at One Crown Office Row.